Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We'll turn our attention now to the presidential race.
Donald Trump.
President Trump.
Donald Trump.
Donald Trump. President Trump.
I'm Donald J. Trump.
You notice the fake news now, right? The lamestream media right there.
Joe Biden.
Vice President Biden.
Joe Biden.
Joe Biden.
You hold the key.
4 more years of Georgia, he's going to find ourselves in a position where if Trump gets elected.
He didn't remember my name. I'm insulted by it.
President Trump did a phenomenal job.
I think the American people would rather hear about more substantial subjects. Well,
got to come together.
In President Trump's America, we light things up.
I don't think anybody's ever seen anything like this in the history of our country politically.
Will you shut up, man?
Listen, this is the most important election in the history of our country.
It seems like barely a day goes past without a mention of Donald Trump, Joe Biden, or both in the daily news, particularly in the lead up to the 2020 presidential election. There are more eyes on the story than ever before. In this episode of Newsfix, how does the politics of a country thousands of kilometres away affect us as Australians? And why should we care about who's in charge of the United States of America? Ahead, we'll talk to 7 News US correspondent Tim Lester, who's on the ground and on the campaign trail in the US. We'll also chat to Sunrise foreign editor Dr. Keith Suter and Professor Simon Jackman from the US Studies Centre. Welcome to Newsfix. I'm Damien Huffenden for 7news.com.au. There's no denying that Donald Trump has polarised not only the United States, but the world. Heralded as the ultimate anti-establishment candidate, when he ran for president in 2016, Trump's ultimate victory and his 4 years as the commander-in-chief have been tainted by allegations of sexual assault, corruption and nepotism, as well as the Russian collusion investigation and an attempted impeachment. On the other side of the fence is Joe Biden, the former vice president under Barack Obama. Biden's past is a stark contrast to Trump's, a former lawyer and prosecutor turned career politician. He's been criticised for his previous decisions on social security, abortion and law reform, as well as the infamous Hunter Biden laptop saga that's still playing out. So, why should we care about American politics here in Australia? We begin with 7 News US correspondent Tim Lester, who spent 17 years covering politics in Canberra. He's now on the campaign trail in Atlanta, Georgia. Now, you are literally weeks into a new assignment in the US. You've hit the ground running with election coverage. How have you found it?
Oh, well, I'm a kid in a lolly shop. it's wonderful. It's a fabulous, fascinating story. It's a foreign environment. I mean, we tend to so much about the US, of course, is familiar to us because Australians have grown up watching US television, and there's a lot of things we know, and yet you're so often tripped up during days, realising that America really is a very different country in a lot of ways. And I've worked here before, but it was a while ago, and coming back, the differences are standing out again, and it's fascinating. And of course, it's a big news time. So for a journalist, it is a kid in a lolly shop moment.
Oh, you're crisscrossing all over the states. You must be. Did you even get over jet lag?
No, I'm actually, as you point out, I'm not far in. I'm only 2 weeks in at the moment. And I think I'm still finding that my alarm clock is blowing me out of bed. In other words, I mean, I'm not waking up gently and happily and getting into the day. I figure what's happening is I'm still I'm still got a bit of the Australian time zone left in me and I'm wanting to sleep because it's about 11 o'clock at night your time when we're waking up here, right? So I'm, I don't think I am fully adjusted, but look, who knows?
All right. Now, you've obviously spent many years covering politics here in Australia. For those who think that voice sounds familiar, Tim was our political correspondent for 7 News for quite a long time. And before that, you've worked for a number of media outlets, obviously. From your point of view, what are you seeing are the big differences between Australia and the US in terms of politics?
Well, there's a lot of practical differences, and the one that I think most Australians would link in straight away with is the celebrated role of the presidency in this country and the separation of the business of electing a president from the election of Congress, which the Americans take very seriously, the separate path that the president takes. Of course, our prime minister is elected as a result of the makeup of the parliament. That doesn't happen here, of course. The president's election is quite separate, though on the same day, on November 3rd, Americans will be voting for their House of Representatives, their lower house of Congress, and their upper house, their Senate as well. And the makeup of those will be very important to the way in which America is governed and to the amount that the president can do over the next 4 years. So, important differences. The other big difference to know going into an American election, of course, is that Americans don't have to vote. And that adds a whole layer of complexity to trying to predict what the outcome is. In Australia, you don't have to worry too much about polls being out based on who's going to turn up and who's not going to turn up because we're all expected to, and, you know, 90% of us do. But in the US, the turnout is a critical factor in the way this election goes.
Now, it's a bit of a bizarre thing because obviously, as you said, voting over there is voluntary. Here in Australia, it's mandatory. It seems like over there, you know, voting is celebrated. You get stickers for voting and everyone posts on social media that, you know, I voted. Whereas here in Australia, most people just turn up for the sausage sizzle. It's a bizarre sort of, you know, difference.
Yeah, I think, a lot of differences in approach. And yes, there's a kind of there's a lot of campaigning to get people to turn out. The Democrats, I think, in particular, of the view that they will win an election more easily the greater the turnout. That the turnout is particularly critical to their cause. Republicans, I think, many Republicans would challenge that, but that certainly seems to be the orthodoxy of American elections and seems to be the case with this one. And interestingly, with this one, we've seen this massive early turnout of voting that Americans haven't experienced before, with the vote already crossing 50 million, now about 139-odd million voted in 2016. So even if we only get the turnout at 2016, where the vote is now is quite remarkable, and they're predicting a turnout beyond 150 million based on this early turnout, although it's difficult to know because, of course, when they're not completely sure whether they're seeing people turn out who would have eventually voted anyway but are just turning out early, perhaps because of the pandemic, or whether they're seeing a greater enthusiasm for voting this time around, that all of the fuss around Donald Trump and the pandemic and so forth is generating people, pushing people to vote who wouldn't have voted. We won't know till after November 3rd.
Now, there's a lot of talk about polls, obviously. You know, Trump's had a lot of fake polls. The polls have Biden in the lead at the moment, but the same was said about, you know, Hillary Clinton 4 years ago. You're crisscrossing around the states. You're talking to some of the voters, as we've seen on 7 News. What are you hearing as you travel around? Is it going to be a Biden win or is it going to be another Trump win, do you reckon?
Well, I think first thing to say is there are a great many Americans who firmly believe that Trump is going to win and win big. We've spoken to any number of those. In fact, I think there might be some sort of bias in people who want to speak to media are more likely Trump supporters in this country. Certainly that seems to be my experience. I've spoken to a lot in a fortnight, a great many, and I reckon I'm getting 60-70% Trump supporters. But personal view, I think the polls are likely right or near right. That's not from any particular experience, except that I think we can read a couple of things looking at the numbers this time around against the way they were 4 years ago. Yes, it's true they got it badly wrong 4 years ago, but I think it's also true that the polls 4 years ago were more volatile than they have been with Biden. I think Biden's lead has been pretty solid. It hasn't moved a lot for a long time. By this stage of the campaign back in 2016, Hillary Clinton's lead had bumped around. The seas were choppier in polling world. And also, Biden's lead is bigger than Clinton's was. Not a lot, but it is bigger. So it's bigger and it's been more consistent. The one caution is that the swing states that will decide the issue tend to be much closer than the national number. The national number is around 9 points difference at this stage, 8 or 9 points in favour of Biden. But if you go into Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Iowa and Florida, the states that are going to decide it, the margins aren't typically that big. So it doesn't require a 9% swing to Trump to get Trump home. It requires something considerably less, I think.
Now, as you're travelling around and obviously speaking to people, are Americans surprised that Australia has such interest in their election?
Yes. Almost universally. Almost universally. And look, it does a lot of the heavy lifting for a reporter that a lot of Americans look on you just as an ordinary media crew, and the moment you open your mouth, there's a mixture of mirth and shock and absolutely interest. Americans are typically, I think, gregarious people. They're outgoing, they're interested. And they're obliging, typically very obliging and helpful, and they're very interested in Australia generally, so usually I start, if I'm going to talk to somebody on camera, as what we call a vox pop, right? Go up and have a chat to a person. I start by pretty quickly get out. I'm from Australian television, from Australia's Seven Network, and almost universally, they're very helpful, which is great, and very interested about where we're from.
Now, you've covered politics in Australia for so long, and now you're over there. What influence does the US have over us here in Australia, both politically and also culturally? Like, what do you see as those influences?
Oh, tremendous influence, and I think the influence perhaps that interests me is the influence on our government in Australia and on the way we're governed. And I think we're going to see if there is a change of administration here in the US, we might see that play out in it reverberating in our government's approach, for example. I think the Trump government's approach to climate change in the Paris Climate Accord has allowed, has, if you like, given cover to those in Australia who don't want climate action, and to the government, our government, being holding back in terms of climate action. I think Biden, if he's true to his word and he does win the presidency, will be far more proactive in terms of climate action. It'll be interesting to see how much pressure that puts on our government to be more proactive. I don't know that that alone, for example, will cause profound change in the Morrison government's climate policy. I wouldn't think it would, but it might make it a little bit more difficult for them to tread the path they've been treading on that policy.
We've spoken about how when we post things on the Seven News social media, on YouTube, a lot of Australians go, you know, this is American, we don't care, it doesn't affect us. Why do you think Australians should be interested in this election and pay attention to what's happening?
Well, because I think it's just wrong to say that it doesn't affect us. In fact, it's extraordinarily important for us. It has influences on our lives and the way our country is run and the well-being of our country at all kinds of levels. I think there's an incentive on our government and there's an incentive in Australia to believe that it doesn't influence us greatly. Maybe it makes people feel more comfortable or feel like that we can afford to be detached from what's happening in governments right around the world, but certainly the one in Washington, that matters to us. Remember, this is the president with the red button, right? This is the superpower. This is really important in terms of the way our part of the world is run, about how we manage our relationship with China and Asia as it changes quite dramatically in our lifetimes, and it's important in the way the world's run. But I think most thinking people know, even if they don't want to spend a lot of time engaged with US politics or global politics or what's happening elsewhere around the world, I think most people accept that decisions in Washington, or for that matter, London or Beijing or Paris or wherever, they matter for our country. They matter a lot. And they're mattering more and more as the, you know, I think as the issues we face are global ones. So we got to be here. We got to look at this stuff. We got to know it.
Obviously, you're on the campaign trail at the moment. You've been on for about 2 weeks now. What is the wildest thing you've seen in the campaign?
The wildest thing. Well, I think Donald Trump is pretty wild to see, full stop, right? I think the most inexplicable thing is the extent to which the Trump campaign is ploughing ahead with business as usual in spite of the pandemic.
Yep.
I think that is a jaw-dropping at a number of levels. I think he thinks that his only way home is to carry out the kind of rallies that he's been carrying out and we've been seeing. I think he believes that that is an important part of what he does, and he's got to do that. And I think, too, he believes that his only way home is to tell the American people and to convince the American people that the pandemic is largely beaten and that we're about to be fine. And we might be. There may be a highly effective vaccine that is about to appear, but I'm not convinced they know that. I think there's an element of guessing in that. So I think seeing that has been significant. I think seeing the utter difference in approach between the Trump campaigns and the Biden campaign, they are almost mirror opposites of one another at the moment. And that's not to say either's necessarily right or wrong, although I do think the Trump campaign is more inexplicable to witness in light of the pandemic.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Tim, fascinating to catch up with you. We'll keep watching your reports on 7 News, and you're even filing some special reports for 7news.com.au, so we'll look forward to that as well. Stay safe over there, Tim, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Great chatting, Damien. Good on you, mate, and good luck with the podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now to Dr. Keith Suter, who's a global futurist, foreign affairs editor for Seven Sunrise, and the host of his own podcast called Global Truths. Keith, welcome.
Thank you.
I didn't even know you had your own podcast.
Yes, this is. I'm getting into the 21st century. This is the new way of communicating, because a lot of people say that with podcasts, they can listen when they're walking the dog or in the gym, etc. It's a whole new way of broadcasting and reaching people.
Let's start with relations between the US and Australia. We've had 4 years with Trump, obviously. 8 years prior to that, Biden was VP with Obama as president. How have relations been under each of those administrations?
Well, Obama era represented a continuity of American politics, so there was no major change. And you've got to bear in mind, there's a very big foreign affairs establishment in the United States, which just continues with the ship sailing in the same direction. So you get changes of presidents. You don't get dramatic changes in the relationship between the United States and Australia. Australia is a major ally of the United States. Australia is the only country to have fought alongside the United States in every war the US fought in the 20th century. And of course, we began the 21st century with cooperating with Britain and the United States in the invasion of Iraq in 2003. So we're seen as very loyal, very dependable. You can take Australia for granted. Now, the Trump era has been different, because Trump generally has just been so erratic and so difficult to work out exactly where he stands. Now, he was promising 4 years ago to withdraw America from overseas commitments. And so he has been pulling America out. He's still trying to get out of Afghanistan and out of Iraq and Syria. He's trying to get out of those commitments, and he really wants to focus far more on the United States. But it hasn't been done in a very coherent way, because basically the foreign policy establishment, what some people would call the deep state, want to keep America involved in those areas. So that's been one of the problems. The other issue for Trump is the relationship with China. So China is undergoing a revival. It's not a rise of China, it's a return. So up until a few centuries ago, one third of global economic activity took place in China. The British then invented the Industrial Revolution in, say, 1750. And then Britain invented the factory method of production and gives us all these manufactured things that we see around us. And at that point, China slipped down. It also fell into chaos with warlords, etc. So what we've seen in the last 70 years has been the revival of China as a major force. The full name of China is People's Republic of China, PRC, which also stands for Please Remain Calm. And so China has been rebuilding itself in terms of its economy. And at some point in the next few years, we'll have a larger economy than that of the United States. Now, that presents a dilemma for the United States and Australia. So we have China as our major trading partner, and yet the United States is our major military ally. We do not want to have to be put in a position where we have to make a choice between one or the other. Now, Trump is ramping up the pressure against China. I think that will also happen if Biden becomes president, because clearly we're on a collision course between the United States and this newly revived China. So that's going to be a real dilemma for us. Now, Trump has not handled this very well. He's highlighted the issue, full marks for that, but has not handled the issue very well. And it's caused, I think, behind closed doors in Canberra, a lot of concern as to what exactly the Americans are up to.
Well, just on that, Trump's obviously been blaming China for COVID-19, calling it the China virus. If he returns to power, what impact is that going to have on their relations?
Well, I think that China would prefer to have Biden as president. I think they could probably do better with Biden. But Biden is also going to have a few hawks around him who will, as I say, this rise of or return of China is so inevitable that there will be a collision at some point between the United States and China. And so China realizes there is this problem. China has been badly damaged by the COVID-19 crisis. It's damaged its trading partners. Okay, China is managing to recover, but its trading partners are not. The United States is not. So that's been one blow to China. And the second problem has been the damage to brand China. I'm amazed now by the anti-Chinese comments that I come across, not against the people themselves, but just this entity called China and the chaos they've caused, the unemployment that we see here in Australia, etc. So China has got a major problem in trying to rebuild links with the Western world. Unfortunately, President Xi is still very much in your face, a very hard-line approach. If I were him, I would just dial it down a bit and try to improve relations with the United States, no matter who's president. But we're not seeing that at the moment.
We've also seen some penalties against Australia in terms of some tariffs that have been penalising our producers and businesses here. Do you think there's any relief in sight for Australia in that respect?
Not in the near future. I'm sorry to be so pessimistic. China is using issues of these types of sanctions almost as a way of punishing punishing Australia for being so friendly towards the United States. You know, it's inventing all sorts of reasons why it's not allowing certain stuff to be imported. It's interesting, it's not touching the iron, because from China's point of view, you can block Australian red wine because you buy more of it from France.
Right.
It's much more difficult to suddenly open up new mines. Eventually, that will happen. China is redesigning the global economy. It's called the Belt and Road Initiative. And so China will be at the centre of the global economy. And so you've got all of these other initiatives underway. You can now, for example, get on a train on the east coast of China, on the seaboard, and get off at the east end of London.
Wow.
So it's a whole new railway line,
yeah,
through connections which they've been able to build. So China's redesigning the global economy, and at some point it will have opened up the iron mines which exist in Africa, but not at the moment.
Not at the moment.
And so Australia still has uses for it, but red wine and other food stuff, we can buy that elsewhere, but not the iron at the moment.
All right, moving off China, mail-in ballots are turning out to be a major issue this time around. There's a lot of controversy around that. What's going on?
Well, I got to say, Donald Trump has made politics interesting. I teach politics to students at Boston University in the United States, and we have record enrollments. And it's not just at Boston. Elsewhere, young Americans, because of 2016, have suddenly taken an incredible interest in what's going on now with American politics. So Trump, full marks, he's been very helpful to political scientists like myself. So you've already got record numbers of people voting before the actual election day, which is November 3 in the United States.
Something like 29% at the moment, I think.
Oh, it's a higher percentage than that. Wow. Oh, no, it's a very high percentage. As a rule, you know, you've got to bear in mind that in the United States, voting is not compulsory.
Yeah.
More Americans used to vote in American Idol than vote in presidential contests.
That's amazing.
60% of Americans vote, so 40% can't be bothered.
Wow.
But I think we're going to, this year, see a record turnout. And we already see a record enrollment in these mail-in ballots. Now, there are two types of ballots, and this is what's causing the problem. One is the absentee ballot. In other words, and it goes all the way back to the American Civil War in the 1860s. In other words, you're a soldier deployed away from your home You are therefore allowed to apply for a ballot. You fill in the ballot and you send it back to your home state where it'll be counted. There's probably no great difficulty with that. The issue that Trump is concerned about is the way in which some states, particularly because of COVID, are saying to people, don't come to the polling station. We will mail the ballot to you. And so Trump is saying this automatic mailing out to people who may have the wrong address or could be stolen in the mail and filled in by other people.
I could be dead.
Could be dead. that's what Trump is about. But there is a bigger issue with Trump. Trump is already trying to discredit the result. So if he does badly after November 3, he will be able to say, there we are, I told you so, it's all a big hoax, the Democrats have been fiddling around with the ballots. So he's already getting ready to discredit the election result because he, deep down, perhaps he fears that he's going to fail. If he wins, of course, he'll be able to say, well, there we are, we're able to triumph in the end.
Yep.
But if he loses, he'll be able to blame this. And then we will have this protracted issue that goes on. It's a very complicated way in which the Americans conduct their elections. You've got to have someone in place by midday on January 20.
Right.
That's in the Constitution.
Wow.
Midday, January 20. So you've got to, that's the deadline. But what you could end up with now would be a series of legal challenges. Both sides are employing lots of lawyers, lawyering up, as they say. And if it goes to the Supreme Court, well, coincidentally, Donald Trump has just appointed 3 judges to the Supreme Court. They might well look after his interests. You remember back in the year 2000 when we had the dispute over the result between Al Gore and George W. Bush. In the end, the dispute was over Florida, and the Supreme Court ruled, stop counting in Florida, we will hand the election. This was in January. We will hand the election across to George W. Bush. So he was appointed by the Supreme Court rather than actually being elected by the United States voters.
There's also a lot of speculation around about the mail service. There's been cutbacks in the US Postal Service, and now there's also reports that a lot of the ballots won't be counted after a certain date. Do you think it's possible that, you know, all those cuts have been put in place to help Trump?
Well, that's the allegation.
Yeah.
And the head of the US Postal Service, which, by the way, is a very distinguished organisation, it's older than the Republic, right? It takes you all the way back to the colonial days when Britain was running 13 colonies in North America. So it's a very distinguished part of the US government, a very old part of the government, but it is subject to political appointees, and the current head of it is a Trump supporter. So that is obviously a worry. And, of course, they've been cutting back, as you say, on the distribution points where you can actually put in the ballots. The basic problem for President Trump, as it is for the Republican Party, is the more people who vote, the greater is the risk of a Republican defeat, because it means that the net is being thrown more broadly into the more marginal areas, people of colour, etc. If they get to vote, then it reduces the chance of a Trump re-election.
Let's talk about the debates and the town halls we've seen over the last month or so. Do you think those sorts of events have any sway with undecided voters?
They used to, but not this time. What is remarkable this time round is just how few undecided voters there are. People have made their votes up. People already wrote voting before the debates took place. They'd already made up their mind. They'd asked for the ballot forms. They were not that worried about hearing what went on. It was just as well because, as you know, the first debate was a shambles, largely because of President Trump's behaviour. The second one was cancelled because of the COVID crisis. The third one was much more respectable, much more restrained. But by that time, a lot of people had already voted. So there were very few, actually, to win over. One of the interesting things about President Trump, which is pretty well unique of all recent presidents, is that he has never achieved majority support. But then the level of his support has never gone below about 40%. It's been a steady group of people who have supported him for the last 4 years. It's almost a cult. So it's going to be very interesting if they trudge through the snow in November to vote.
Well, just on that, Trump also seems to have a strong supporter base here in Australia. Why do you think people that are thousands of miles away would throw their support behind the leader of another country?
Well, I think that Trump, what he has to say resonates with people. There is concern about the return of China to the international scene. You know, we've already dealt with what they're doing with our farmers. So there's that angle to it. There's also the fact that Trump is responding to all the political correctness and all this sort of stuff. People are just worn out by the culture wars. As I say, I teach young Americans. They are now very careful about what they say. They don't want to offend their fellow classmates. You can get deplatformed. And it's amazing what he's done to people on the left in terms of making them so anxious, et cetera. So I think there are a lot of people who are just saying, look, good old Trump, he's saying what we all believe. So, yes, I can see why there is this almost a cult following for him in parts of Australia. I come across it whenever I'm broadcasting that there are people on talkback radio who are great supporters of Trump. And of course, Trump is helped because Biden is such a weak performer.
There are officials saying that Iran and Russia have sourced voter information and sent emails with fake information to voters, but they've stopped short of calling this a hack. What's the issue here?
Well, I think if you go back to 2016, Mrs. Clinton, when she was trying to explain her defeat, didn't say I was not a good candidate, which she was a bad candidate. And so a lot of traditional Democrat voters didn't bother to support her. Instead, she blamed the Russians.
Right.
Right? So I think there's an element of that going on already, that people are blaming the Russians and Iranians. Now, it may well be they are trying to interfere in the election, but as I've said, a lot of people have already made up their mind. A lot of people have already voted. Putin would clearly be a supporter of President Trump. We're not yet sure of the exact relationship between Trump and some of the financial interests in Russia. So I should imagine that that Putin wants Trump to be re-elected. In the case of Iran, that's a question of internal politics. So you've got a moderate leader in Iran who is probably going to lose his job, and the hardliners want to have a confrontation with the United States. So it may well be that's an issue of internal politics. I don't think that either intervention is really going to have much of an impact on American politics any more than that happened in 2016.
What do you think Australia can expect if Trump returns for a second term?
Well, if Trump returns, I think we can expect even more turbulence. Remember, he's not running for re-election now, so he's got 4 years of a clear run. Who knows what will happen under that? So it'd be certainly instability, be great problems for the Australian government trying to reaffirm the value of the alliance with the United States when there'd be a lot of people who'd just be rolling their eyes, saying, oh, no, this is such an embarrassment. If Biden gets re-elected, I think it'll be a return to the normal era that we've had under recent presidents before Trump. A pivot towards Asia, which is what President Obama talked about, when he was visiting us in Australia. He said that the United States has been too focused on the war on terror, and we've got to pay more attention to the rise of China. So there will still be problems for us because clearly, as I say, the Americans and Chinese are perhaps on a collision course. So there will still be problems, but at least there'll be more stability, I think, within the White House. It'll also be a very boring time.
You won't have much to really talk about with your students.
No, that's exactly it.
just quickly, how is the relationship between Scott Morrison and Trump at the moment?
Again, very difficult to work out. Scott Morrison, I think, would see himself ideologically linked up with Trump. With Trump, everything is transactional. There is no relationship. Everything is a quid pro quo. We're looking for the deal, etc. So the relationships between those two individuals may not be all that clear. But remember, you've got these deep-seated centres of power, what would be called the deep state, in the United States, in Washington, D.C., and in Canberra. And you've got people there who are saying, we've got to keep together with the United States. Trump is just a passing phenomenon. Don't panic. He'll eventually leave office one way or another. We've got to make sure that our two countries stay on an even keel.
Just finally, why should Australians be paying attention to this election? What is it that we really need to focus on in this presidential race?
Well, Australians often think about the bottom line. And clearly, the Americans have handled the COVID crisis badly. It's affected the American economy, not Wall Street. Forget Wall Street. That's not a good indicator of the state of the American economy. But in terms of ordinary Americans, there's no relief package at the moment. So you've got all sorts of problems there. And we rely on the United States as an important part of the international financial system. So we have a vested interest in how well America goes. Remember the old saying that America sneezes and Australia catches a cold? We've therefore, in our own financial interests, got to pay attention to this. Secondly, as I've already indicated, there is this bigger issue between the United States and China, which has direct impact on Australia. So we ought to be getting a vote, I think, in the American elections, because whoever is president will have certainly affect Australia's outcome.
A bit like Eurovision.
That's right.
All right. Well, based on everything that you've seen, that you've experienced, that we've talked about, who do you foresee being the next president?
Impossible to predict. The advice that I'm giving people is that, okay, Trump is behind in the polls, but don't think that Biden is necessarily going to win. Mm. There are what are called secret Trump voters. In other words, people who will not reveal they're going to vote for Trump, but in the privacy of the election booth, where not even the National Security Agency can spy on you, there you may well decide to vote for Trump. We just don't know. Trump is a phenomenon. We have never known a president like this for many years. I'm just trying to think, you know, how far you've got to go back to. Well, they don't even have business people in the White House. Business people know they already run the country. They don't waste time in politics. The last one was Herbert Hoover, who made his money mining gold in Western Australia.
Wow.
And then retired as a very rich person and then went into US politics. That was at the eve of the Great Depression. And now we're on the eve of another Great Depression and we've got another business person in the White House.
All right. Interesting as always, Dr. Keith Suter. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Now, Simon Jackman is the CEO of the United States Study Centre in Sydney. He was born and raised in Brisbane, but is a dual citizen of Australia and the US, so has a unique insight into the situation. Simon, thanks for your time. Can you give us just a quick rundown of your background and your interest in the United States political system?
Oh, sure. Well, I grew up a politics nerd in Queensland a long time ago and attracted very much to the data side of the study of politics. And my professors at the University of Queensland said I really ought to go to the United States for that. And so I did. But I think it begins with trying to peer inside the black box. For many people, politics is mysterious and sinister even. And I've always been attracted to the idea that with data and careful study, we can unpick things that we say, oh, that's getting very political. Well, let's see if we can get inside what we mean by that using the tools of science, with data and statistical analysis being key among them. Politics is fundamentally a numbers game, majority rule, the way we draw lines on maps for creating electoral systems, the voting systems, preferential voting, all these different mechanisms and institutions we have in the world of democratic politics in particular. There's an awful lot we can learn about what's going on there through the application of scientific methods, and that's been kind of my life's passion, frankly. Yeah.
Now, just on that.
That's not American politics, per se. You want to know about American politics,
well,
I guess.
Say, because the election, the American electoral system is vastly different to Australia's, even though
right.
we are both technically democracies. So can you explain how that works and how it differs to Australia? And I know that's a big task, but how do they differ?
It's pretty straightforward, actually. There's a couple of key differences for Australians to keep in mind. I think the first one is that they don't have compulsory voting, and that just fundamentally changes the rules of the game, the way the politicians conduct themselves and the way the parties conduct themselves. The other thing is that it's not preferential voting, and particularly voting for the presidency not only is it not preferential, it's this odd system where the presidential election in particular is a state-by-state election, and it's winner-take-all virtually in every state, meaning that whoever wins a state, be it by one vote or be it by a million votes, you win all of the delegates that are available to that state. And these delegates are allocated to the state, roughly in proportion to the population of the state, not exactly, but pretty close. And it's those delegates, whoever has the most delegates at the end of the election, that's who wins the presidency. So it's not a mass election, at least not directly. It begins as a series of mass elections in each state, and then winner take all by state, and then these delegates actually decide who wins. And so what that means, and this is the thing that's really puzzling to a lot of outsiders, is that you can win more votes than your opponent across the entire country, but still lose the election. And so that happened to Hillary Clinton in 2016. She outpolled Donald Trump nationally, but Trump won more delegates. Why? Because he won just the right number of states by very small margins, whereas Hillary Clinton won a huge vote margin in California, but it didn't really matter. She was always going to win California. She didn't need to win it by 3 million votes or whatever she won it by. And so we ended up in this situation where Hillary Clinton beat Trump handily, but Trump won the election. And that's happened a few times in American history. It actually happens in Australia every now and then. We sometimes see the winner of a House of Representatives election not, you know, you can win the seats but not win the votes. And so you can form a government in the House of Representatives even though you got less votes than your opponent. And so that happened in 1998 when the John Howard government was reelected. They narrowly were outpolled by the Labor Party. And then Labor did it to the coalition back in 1990. So we see these things. They're nowhere near as kind of prominent or extreme as what we sometimes see in America. But this is one of the quirks of these systems of voting that every country has. But the United States one is particularly quirky and when it comes to the voting for the president. And indeed, you know, if Trump is reelected, that's exactly how he will do it. He will almost certainly get fewer votes than Joe Biden. And what this election is really all about is Trump going to win the delegate count? And that means, is he going to pick off just the right states by just the right margins and translate what is nationally a pretty weak hand into a winning hand with that delegate count?
So when we talk about delegates, obviously we're talking about the Electoral College, which we hear so much about.
That's it, the Electoral College, yep.
Now, you're a statistician, you're a data-driven guy. Do you think that is a sensical way to do an election? Like, is that a way that is fairly representative of the people?
No, is the short, literal answer. It was designed... It was like all these things. It was a political compromise thrashed out when America was being formed so that, you know, big states wouldn't dominate small states, so that free states wouldn't dominate the slave states of the South by giving states power in the electorate. Now, the Australian Constitution has a few little quirks like this too. Tasmania has 12 seats in the Senate. Right, as does New South Wales. So big disparities in population, but we have at least the Australian Senate. We allocate political power to the states, not to the people, if you will. We dilute the votes of people in New South Wales relative, and Victoria and big states relative to a small state like Tasmania. The other thing is Tasmania gets 5 seats in the House of Reps. That's guaranteed by the Constitution of Australia, that no matter how small Tasmania's population might be relative to the mainland states, it's always going to have at least 5 seats in the House of Reps. So all around the democratic world, we see these things. The really odd one about the United States is the way it maps onto when it really sorts out by the partisanship and the preferences of the people in these states. And geography counts for a lot now in the United States. So the South and the Plain States, the Farm States, are very strong Republican parts of the country. And the big urban states on the coast in particular have become overwhelmingly Democratic. So, you know, from a Democrat's perspective, it seems horribly unfair that so much of their vote is quote-unquote locked up in California or locked up in New York State and not spread more efficiently across the country. But at various points in American history, the shoe will be on the other foot. But we're living through a moment now where it seems that Republicans, that particular system, does confer some advantage. You know, small states tend to be Republican states in the United States at the moment, but it hasn't always been that way.
Now, we've spoken about the polls and particularly about Hillary Clinton's loss back in 2016.
Trump's, oh, my goodness, yes.
Well, Trump's spending a lot of time now saying that the polls that say Joe Biden's in the lead and that he's going to win, they're fake news, they're fake polls. You know, his polls show that he's going to win. You know, are there any basis for the claims that the polls are wrong, or is it just the fact that the Electoral College will get involved that means he still might win?
The Electoral College will be involved, and he still might win. But if you look at the polls right now in the states he really needs to win in order to pull this off, losing the vote nationally but winning the Electoral College, the public polling suggests he's not going to do it. The public polling is pointing at states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Florida, North Carolina, states that Trump won last time that had previously gone for Obama. And the public polling is saying Trump is behind, and behind by a lot. Now, the problem is the poll said exactly the same thing in virtually all those states and by almost, uncannily, almost the same margins in 2016, saying that Hillary Clinton was going to win those states. And on the back of that, everybody thought, well, Hillary Clinton's likely to win this election. And so many analysts in, you know, that I'm in touch with, and journalists all around the world, everybody is treading very carefully at these polls because you don't want to make the same mistake twice. And Trump, I saw it myself today. There's some interviews from his staff as well suggesting that, you know, their private polling is showing them not just in front, but comfortably in front. And my sense is, boy, I would love to see those polls. because all the public polling, right? There's nothing in the public polling that suggests that that's what's going to happen. Now, again, we just keep coming back to, well, geez, you know, they got it right in 16. They eked out these very narrow wins and got over the line in the Electoral College. You know, maybe it's going to happen again. And the scenario that everybody is thinking that, you know, if Trump wins, here's how it happens. It's that just as he did in 16, he's able to pull off the couch and into the polling place people that typically don't have a lot to do with politics, that don't take polls, that aren't really engaged with politics, but for various reasons, Donald Trump excites them. He's an outsider. He's entertaining. He's outrageous. He's promising to shake things up and to make America great again. And Trump found a whole bunch of people like that in 16. The question is, are the pollsters now counting them properly, or are there even more people like that out there that Trump is going to bring into the electorate in a way that will surprise even the best pollsters who are sort of trying to catch up to 2016? A lot of pollsters will tell you they've done that. If Trump wins, it'll be by confounding the pollsters by doing exactly what he did in 16, and that is just bringing people into the American political system that typically don't vote and hence aren't very visible to pollsters or the political parties. And that's what this election is boiling down to.
Now, we're talking about the people who aren't engaged in politics. Stepping outside of the US, it seems there's a lot of interest in US politics around the world, and particularly in Australia now, ever since Trump took office. And I believe in a way that we've never quite seen before, particularly with Obama in office. Like, we cared, obviously. It was great. You know, we've had visits from US presidents in the past and whatever. But there seems to be a real interest in the day-in, day-out functions of US politics this time around. Is that something that Trump's brought with him? You know, he's bringing in people who previously just weren't engaged in politics.
Well, you're right. It's happening in Australia too. And I mean, for us at the US Study Center, but I'm sure for you at Channel 7 and colleagues all over media in Australia, but media all over the world, the Trump bump in ratings, in viewership, in levels of interest, in news and in current affairs is just gone through the roof. And why is that? Yes, it is Trump specific. And yes, there was a bump with Obama. The spectacle, right, the historical significance of an African American man becoming president of the United States and winning re-election as well, and what that meant historically, and coming after the George W. Bush presidency, which was not a popular presidency, particularly outside the United States, it was thought to represent sort of a new day, a new era for the United States. And Trump, I mean, just the spectacle, he's so unconventional and so outrageous that there is, look, it's a mix of entertainment value for some people. But then I think also there's a sense that, you know, we all look to the United States. It's the most powerful democracy on the planet. It is Australia's, by a country mile, our most important foreign relationship strategically, in defense, in trade and investment as well. You name a domain, you know, and our connection to the United States through that domain, be it entertainment, be it culture, be it social media, be it sports that people follow. There is so much connectivity between Australia and the United States, both in the government level but also out among ordinary people, that we can't help but pay a ton of attention to what's going on there and thinking about what it might mean for Australia, both in an official way. Is the defence alliance intact? What is this aggression towards China coming out of the United States? Where is that coming from? What does it mean for Australia? Right through to the cultural trends. If the United States, the world's most powerful democracy, its leader is starting to call into question the legitimacy and the validity of some of those institutions, that can't help but reverberate here, just given all the way we are plugged in and consuming so much American culture and the crossover, the transfer of ideas, both on the left and the right, of politics into Australia, the way that, you know, it took the Black Lives Matter rallies in the United States provoked, you know, people getting in the middle of a pandemic here in Australia, people taking to the streets here to protest similar issues here in Australia. You look at Me Too, you look at Occupy Wall Street, you look at, on the right, libertarian ideas that are really driving conservative thought in Australia, find their inspiration from their American colleagues. So there's tons of those connections and crossover. And I think that's fueling it as well. And Trump's just this crazy spectacle that just won't stop. Every 8 hours, it seems, there's a new cycle within a new cycle within a new cycle with Trump. And so this crazy pace of disruption overlaid on what is already such thick architecture between Australia and the United States, I think helps explain the insanely high levels of interest we're seeing from Australians with respect to this presidential election.
Now, one of the, I guess it's a criticism we get here when we put up stories about the United States, about Trump, about Biden, is this is Australia, you know, why do we care about America? From your studies and from your point of view, why should Australians care about this election and the outcome of this presidential election?
Yeah, US-China competition in particular is going to shape the rest of the 21st century. Where the US lands on climate change is going to shape the future potentially of the planet, you might even argue. There's an awful lot at stake in indirect ways out of what happens there. And then I go back to, you know, what I was just talking about earlier, and that is the strategic relationship we have at a government-to-government level. Australian security policy is premised on the alliance with the United States, of there being this incredibly big security defense backstop from the United States. And every Australian government constantly has to ask how reliable and how deep and what will be the capabilities that would be brought to bear should push ever come to shove in the region. That's your obligation when you're a senior public servant charged with defence or foreign affairs, when you're in the military, when you're a political leader in Australia, in the national government. And that has been true in Australian strategic thinking since World War II. And when the US and China start, the heat in that relationship turns up, of course there are consequences for Australia. And Australia has its own view about China's assertiveness and is pursuing its own interests, but it is equally interested in what is America's mindset towards China and how America is prosecuting its grievances with China and the way they complement or cut across Australia's national interests. And so in government, it is of immense importance who becomes president of the United States, and in particular, what will the differences be in the way, say, a second Trump administration will pursue foreign policy. How much of a priority will it give to the Indo-Pacific and this region versus a Biden administration? And so it's not just a spectator sport for people who are thinking about Australia's national security and our future, our prosperity. It is far from a spectator sport. There's intense scrutiny looking for policy signals about areas of emphasis. Does the Biden administration think it's got to restore its alliances with NATO and take some of the focus away from the Indo-Pacific that the Trump administration has been bringing to bear here? And then I guess the other big question is, how quickly can America recover from COVID? And again, that's in tied up in the election outcome. Biden said, you know, we expect to see a more coordinated policy response should he win the election, and you know, depending on the timing of the arrival of a vaccine. But Australia and indeed the global economy needs the American economy to get up back up on its feet and start firing again. That's important for Australia's economic prosperity in the long run. But also, again, it feeds into the security quotient as well. An America that is crippled by COVID and its economy is crippled by COVID, at some point that starts to erode the ability of the United States to be a global superpower. And again, that starts to impact Australia's national interests as well. So there's quite a few vectors there before. And then we get to the climate change story too. Biden is talking a huge game on climate change, $1.7 trillion in investment in renewable technologies and a transition to a renewable future over 10 years. That will be game changing. Australia will find that its nearest and closest ally has vaulted from it being on its right flank with respect to climate change, skepticism about climate change and skepticism about multilateral agreements and whatnot, to being exactly the opposite. And there can't help but be a knock-on effect for climate change policy in this country if the United States, as big and as powerful and as thought-leading it is, vaults in the way that Biden is talking about. So there are three really big areas of connection that I think transcend kind of the spectator sport aspect of this, like what is Trump going to do today, drama. There's some really big issues grinding away, perhaps not always making the headlines, but of vital importance to Australia and its long-term future.
Well, I guess the biggest and final question for you is, as a data-driven person, as someone who knows the United States, as someone who works at the U.S. Study Center, I guess less of an opinion and more of based on what you've seen and your experience, you know, who are you feeling will be the next president of the United States?
Look, probably Biden, and that's as far as I can go, because let me say this. If this were any other election, if I was seeing this stream of poll results, the rates of early voting, the incumbents, Trump's approval ratings, things like that, if I was seeing all of that data and it wasn't Donald Trump and I didn't have the experience of the numbers being wrong just 4 years ago the way they were, you would look at this stream of data and you go, this isn't even close. This thing is over. It is done. Let's move on. But because it's Donald Trump and because it's coming 4 years after that big miss by some of those state-by-state polls in particular, I can't say Trump's out of it. And so you know, some of the big forecasters in the US, Nate Silver at 538 and G. Elliott Morris, the Economist gang, and, you know, there's a whole bunch of them, the Real Clear people as well. You know, I've interacted with these people professionally, you know, over the years, and I see the numbers they're putting out now, you know, that Trump's got basically on the low end, it might be 8% up to a high end of about 15. I actually think it's higher than that. I think it's, you know, I'd put it somewhere closer to 30% chance of winning, because not only might the polls be wrong, but we're in this crazy environment of massive voter turnout trying to find its way through to the ballot box in the middle of a pandemic. No one actually knows how that cashes out. Big differences in mail voting and people standing in lines and all this sort of stuff all over the country. And then all the legal challenges as to the validity of, you know, casting a mail ballot this way or that way, or when does the ballot have to arrive? I just think there's all this other room. The polls could be right, but, you know, but there's just all this other room for slippage, if you will, between what people are telling the pollsters and what's going to show up on the scoreboard at the end of the election. So I cannot count Donald Trump out, and I'm just nowhere near as bullish about Biden's chances. I think on balance, yeah, probably, but not quite as bullish as some of the other forecasters I see out there.
And let's face it, no one knows how to rally the troops like Trump.
Yeah, right. And this, we're seeing exactly what he did 4 years ago. And he is going to all the states he needs, right? It is Florida, it is Pennsylvania. And the guy is doing three rallies a day, a 74-year-old. He is thrashing it in the home stretch. And just as he did in 16. And the nightmare for the Dems is that he pulls out, as I said earlier, these occasional voters. He is just pulling people out of the woodwork and getting them to vote in these kind of more rural, a little more sparsely populated parts of these swing states, just like he did in 16. You can't rule that out. There are a lot of people out there who don't vote yet that he could draw on. The trick is it too little, too late? And, you know, we'll know in about, you know, about this time next week, I suppose.
All right. Well, it's been a fascinating insight into the US election, and I know, you know, we'll be certainly here watching it and covering it here for Seven. Simon Jackman from the United States Studies Center, thank you for your time.
Well, Damien, thank you so much. A pleasure.
So there you have it. Plenty of reasons for you to keep across the presidential race. You can stay up to date at 7news.com.au, and of course 7 News will have extensive coverage as the count unfolds. I'm Damien Haffenden, and this has been Newsfix for 7news.com.au.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.